Please join me in 1 Kings chapter 22. We're going to start at verse 41 today. And I remind you that we have to kind of do some bouncing around inside of the Kings, as well as back and forth to the Chronicles, in order to get all of the chronological information that we need to talk about the divided kingdom period. We've got the southern kingdom of Judah in the south. That's the Davidic kingdom. It's where the temple's located. And then we've got the northern kingdom of Israel to the north. And we've had several dynasties in that kingdom during the past 60-some years of its existence. And several assassinations have taken place. The current king, as we begin today, in northern Israel, is Ahab, whom we know as a very notorious figure of Israeli history. When Jehoshaphat becomes king in the southern kingdom of Judah, Ahab has only been on the throne for about 4 years. And these two kings are going to be in our story for quite some time now, because a lot of things happen during their kingdoms, and some very disastrous things for the faith. So 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 41 says, Jehoshaphat, the son of Asa, began to reign over Judah in the fourth year of Ahab, king of Israel. Now, according to my chronology, that would be sometime in 881 BC, probably in the second half, in the fall or winter of that particular year. Continuing, verse 42. Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 25 years in Jerusalem. So his father does not pass away until Jehoshaphat is in his mid-30s. So Jehoshaphat is not going to have a super long reign, not when compared to several of the other kings, because he's only on the throne about 25 years before he passes away. His mother's name was Azubah, the daughter of Shilhi. He walked in all the way of Asa, his father. Now remember, that's a reference to Asa's early years and his early attitude. Unfortunately, Asa in his later years became rebellious against God and persecuted a prophet and those who followed in the ways of that prophet. But in his earlier years, he was a good man, and so Jehoshaphat is following that earlier example. Continuing in verse 43, he did not turn aside from it, doing what was right in the sight of He who is. So unlike his father, he is not going to go bad. He will make some poor choices, there's no doubt about that, but when he is corrected, he seems to humbly accept that correction from God and God's servants. Now there is a note here about some problems in the Judean kingdom at this time. It says, yet the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and made offerings on the high places. Now there's two ways that we can understand this, and I am genuinely uncertain as to how to take it. First of all, it could be a reference to the idea that earlier in the kingdom, people had started worshiping the true and living God by doing their own little personal altars at certain places throughout the kingdom, on high places. You typically selected a place that was a higher elevation, the top of a hill, a ridgeline, something like that, where you put your altar up. So it's possible that what we're talking about here is a breaking of the rule that the only sacrifices in Judea are supposed to be taking place at Jerusalem. So that's the better of the two choices. The other possibility is that we know false worship has come into the lives of the Judean people, and that they've been worshiping other gods and goddesses. That started under Solomon, and it continued through Rehoboam and Abijah, and even apparently under Asa. So it's possible that that's what we're being told, is that there's some certain secret sites of pagan worship throughout Judea, and that Jehoshaphat doesn't manage to get all of those shut down. Verse 44, Jehoshaphat also made peace with the king of Israel, and that would be a reference to Ahab, who is his counterpart in the northern kingdom. Now, how does he make that that agreement of treaty? Well, we'll discover later that it will involve a promise of intermarriage between the two royal families. Now, I want you to think about this for a moment, that by marrying these two families together, the royal family of Judah and the royal family of northern Israel, the offspring, the first male born to that marriage, is going to have the right to rule over both kingdoms, which in effect would be the reuniting of the two kingdoms. And I really think that that's what they had in mind when they agreed to this marriage treaty. So that was probably negotiated early on after Jehoshaphat was made king of Judah, and then was brought to fruition a few years later when the young people were old enough to get married. Okay, back to 2 Chronicles chapter 17 now, because we have to bounce around, remember. 2 Chronicles 17 describes Jehoshaphat's kingdom in this fashion. Jehoshaphat, his son, reigned in his place and strengthened himself against Israel. So when Jehoshaphat first comes to the throne, there is tension between the two kingdoms. There's been recent border skirmishes because the border is effectively only a handful of miles north of the king or the city of Jerusalem, the capital city of the legitimate throne of David. So we start out with some tension, but that's going to be resolved. But here is what he did while the tension was there. Verse 2, he placed forces in all the fortified cities of Judah and set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim that Asa his father had captured. So during the border skirmishes, there had been the capture of certain cities across the border into northern Israel. The northern Israelis had recaptured certain cities back, Bethel being one of them. But a few of the others inside of that bulge, that bubble northward, remained under Israeli control, under Judean control. And so Judean forces were put into those cities to fortify them, to keep them from being retaken by the northern kingdom. Verse 3, he who is was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the earlier ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals. Now, Baal is a singular god. He is the thunder and lightning god of the Middle East. He is worshipped with an upstanding stone, and he has a consort, wife, sister named Asherah, who is the goddess of the grain and the goddess of heaven. She's worshipped by an upstanding wooden object, either a living tree or some sort of carved out tree, kind of similar to a totem pole, I would guess. Well, the reason the plural is used here is because anywhere that Baal is represented by an idol, that is an individual worshiping of Baal. And so there's multiple sites of Baal all over northern Israel. So there's multiple Baals. And that's the reason the plural happens from time to time. All right, but Jehoshaphat, he's not into that. He refuses to worship anyone but he who is the God of Israel, who created heaven and earth, who brought the Israelis out of Egypt to the promised land. Verse 4, but he sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments and not according to the practices of Israel. Therefore, he who is established the kingdom in his hand, and all Judah brought tribute to Jehoshaphat, and he had great riches and honor. His heart was courageous in the ways of he who is, and furthermore, he took the high places and the Asherim out of Judah. So he got rid of all of the pagan worship sites that he knew about, that he could find, and eradicated them. They'd apparently popped up under his father, Asa, during those later bad years. So those are now gotten rid of. And the worship of Baal, the worship of Asherah, is only taking place on the sly in southern Judah. Verse number 7, I find interesting because it matches exactly with the chronology that I've worked out in my studies. I believe that 878 BC, which was the third year of Jehoshaphat's reign, was the 77th sabbatical year of the Israeli nation. And we know that they took an entire year off during a sabbatical year, didn't do their regular work, just kind of relaxed. It was like their vacation year. But it was also often used as a renewal year spiritually. So I find it very interesting that in this third year of Jehoshaphat's reign, verse number 7 of 2 Chronicles 17 says, he sent out his officials, Ben-Ha'il, Obadiah, Zechariah, Netanel, and Micaiah, to teach in the cities of Judah. Now, what are they going to teach? They're going to teach the faith of he who is. Continuing, with them, the Levites, Simeiah, Netanyahu, Zebaniah, all the IAHs that you see at the end of these names actually represents the divine name in shortened form, Yah. And so there's a name component, all these referencing back to the true and living God. When you see an EL, as part of a name component, that's generally a reference to God generally. But when it's in a Hebrew name, it is to he who is specifically. Asahel, Zimraimot, Yahonatan. And when you see a J-E-H at a beginning of a English written Hebrew name, that's typically the divine name also in shortened form. Adonijah, Tobiah, Toberdoniah, and with these Levites, the priests Elishama and Jehoram. And they taught in Judah, having the book of the law of he who is with them. So verse number 9 makes it crystal clear. These priests and Levites, scribes, teachers, they take the written word of God with them on this teaching tour. And remember that This is long before the printing press. So in order to have a copy of the Word of God, it had to be done by hand. And it also took up a lot of room because you had to do scrolls of the individual books. And more than likely, when it talks about the book of the law of he who is here, it's talking about at least the five books of Moses. But it could also include the book of Joshua and the book of Judges. Those certainly would have been produced by now. And probably the book of Ruth, because we're well past the time of David. David lived more than 140 years before this. That was when his reign began. And his great-grandparents' love story would certainly have been available in written form. So those could have been bound up together with these other books and called the Book of the Law of the Lord. And then, of course, we've got the Psalms that are out there, the Proverbs that were out there during the time of King Solomon, and we've got the prophetic writers of 1 and 2 Samuel, and maybe even a little bit of the early Kings and Chronicles that are also available. So what I'm saying is these guys are taking all sorts of scrolls with them as they go around to the different places of the kingdom of Judah during the sabbatical year. And interestingly, because it's the 77th sabbatical year, the year following will be the 11th year of Jubilee, and it's a second holiday year. It's a second year that's off. So effectively, these gentlemen, these teachers of the law, could have spent two entire years going around the cities of Judah and offering not just readings from the Word of God, but the ability to hand copy so that the local groups of prayer and worship could have their own copies of some of these writings. And they also tried to explain them to the people. So it was quite the motivation to be brought back to a right relationship with the true and living God during these couple of years. And that contributed, I think, greatly to the good years of the kingdom of Judah under Jehoshaphat, and why they escaped the judgments of God that were being placed on the northern kingdom during this same period of time. Verse number 10. The fear of he who is fell upon all the kingdoms of the lands that were around Judah, and they made no war with Jehoshaphat. Now that matches what had been promised by God in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses' final sermon, that if the people of Israel would just live according to the covenant, if they would just seek God's face, God would protect them from all of the nations around them, that he would put the fear of God and God's people into those other nations and make them behave themselves. And so this is probably contributing exactly to what we see here. Verse 11, some of the Philistines brought Jehoshaphat presents and silver for tribute. So the Philistines are living semi-independent lives at the western edge of the kingdom of Jehoshaphat. David had had them under his control, so had Solomon, but they seem to have kind of uprisen after that. But now they want to be in good relationship with the kingdom of Jehoshaphat. Not just them. The Arameans, the Arabs, those that live over on the east and south of the kingdom of Judah, the Bedouins, basically. Arab has to do with southerners. That's the kind of idea that it gives. So it's a reference to the southern deserts at the fringe of the Middle East. So the Arabians, also brought him 7,700 rams and 7,700 goats. So they bring him tribute in animals. Verse 12, Jehoshaphat grew steadily greater. He built in Judah fortresses and store cities, and he had large supplies in the cities of Judah. He had soldiers, mighty men of valor in Jerusalem, and this was the muster of them by fathers' houses. So here's what he can call on to defend the kingdom of Judah. Of Judah, the commanders of thousands, Adna, the commander, with 300,000 mighty men of valor. Next to him was Jehohanan, the commander, with 280,000. Next to him, Amasiah, the son of Zikri, a volunteer for the service of He Who Is, with 200,000 men of valor. Of Benjamin, because Benjamin, at least a large portion of the Benjamin tribe, is associated with the Judean kingdom. Eliada, a mighty man of valor, with 200,000 men armed with bow and shield. And next to him, Jehozabad, with 180,000 armed for war. These were in the service of the king, besides those whom the king had placed in the fortified cities throughout all Judah. So there are over a million militia members, well-trained and on call as needed to protect the kingdom of Judah during this time. And this is part of the peace process that happens between Jehoshaphat and the surrounding nations and between Jehoshaphat and the kingdom of northern Israel. Now, chapter 18, verse number 1. Says, now Jehoshaphat had great riches and honor, and he made a marriage alliance with Ahab. And I'd already referenced that that was coming. About 7 years after the third year of Jehoshaphat, when he sent out those teachers, in other words, in his 10th year, that would be the 78th sabbatical year. And in that particular year, we know that Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram, the heir to the throne in Judah, would have been 20 years of age. So he is well old enough to get married. And so somewhere probably right around that time period, maybe the 8th, 9th, 10th year of Jehoshaphat's reign, he arranges for his son, the heir, to be married to Ahab's daughter, Princess Athaliah. And that is going to set up a great tragedy for later in the kingdom of Judah. But for the time being, there is peace between the two kingdoms. And everything is going very well in the southern kingdom of Judah. But in the northern kingdom, things are not so well. And we're going to kind of begin what we'll talk about starting tomorrow, today, with 1 Kings number 17. 1 Kings chapter 17, where we meet another famous character from this period. Now, Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead. All right, so let's talk about him. Let's introduce him. Eliyahu, that's his Hebrew name, means Yah, or He Who is my God. So he bears a name that declares the big problem with northern Israel. And that is, they don't really have He Who Is as their God. especially under Ahab and Jezebel, because they are in the process of trying to eradicate all belief systems other than Baal and Asherah and all the subservient gods and goddesses under them. So this Elijah is from a town called Tishbe that is across the Jordan River in Gilead. And the best guess for where that's located is about 30 miles east of the capital city of Samaria. So about 10 miles east of the Jordan River in what used to be the notorious forest of Ephraim, a place with lots of old growth forest and lots of ravines and caves and holes in the ground. It's got several different wadis that have carved deep ravines through it. And so he's from that wilderness town of Tishbe. But he has been called by God, the true God of Israel, to deliver a message to Ahab. And here it comes. Verse number one continues. As he who is the God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word. So he comes to probably the capital city of Samaria and announces to the king of Israel, Ahab, you think that your God, Baal, is the thunder and lightning god, the rain god, and you think that your goddess, Asherah, is the grain goddess that produces all of the bounty of the land. But guess what? The true and living God is the one that controls all of that, and he's turning off the tap until further notice. Come back tomorrow, and we'll pick this story up right at this spot.